Thank you, Mr. President, and let me add my welcome to the members of the Forum Club and guests. Ian Fleming, Jack Higgins, John Le Carre, Tom Clancy, Vince Flynn. What do these men all have in common? Well, they are writers of best-selling spy novels, and I would bet most people in this room have read their books. What do most of these books have in common? Well, most of them include a role for a person called the DCI. That stands, as most of you know, for the Director of Central Intelligence, one of the most important positions in the American government, and the position formerly held by our speaker today, General Michael Hayden. The CIA was created under the provisions of the National Security Act of 1947, which charged the CIA with coordinating the nation's intelligence activities, evaluating and disseminating intelligence that affects national security. This changed somewhat under the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act of 2004, under which the position of the DCI was abolished and the job of Director of a Central Intelligence Agency was established. That intelligence reorganization was controversial at the time, and some would say school is still out on the wisdom and efficacy of that move. We may hear something about that. In any event, the head of the CIA now reports to the Director of National Intelligence, a position once held by John Negroponte, who spoke to us here last year. Our speaker, as you know, was DCI from 2006 to 2009, and of course worked closely with Ambassador Negroponte. We are extremely fortunate to have General Hayden with us today to continue our series of excellent speakers in the foreign policy and national security spheres. I won't repeat his biography as it has already been circulated to you. Suffice it to say that he has had a long and very distinguished career in the Air Force and in the national security arena. He has served his country with distinction for over 40 years. He stands in the very impressive shoes of his predecessors at CIA, including our former congressman here, Porter Goss, George Tenet, John Deutsch, James Woolsey, William Webster, and James Schlesinger. I first met General Hayden a few years ago when I was asked to join the advisory board of his current firm, the Chertoff Group. When the general left government at the end of the Bush presidency, he and Michael Chertoff, the former Secretary of Homeland Security, formed a business to engage in security consulting and global and terrorist risk assessment. Their firm includes several former CIA officials, former New York City police officers, and such international experts as the former head of British MI5, the former head of Scotland Yard, and the former UK Home Secretary. Impressive. I should also disclose that the firm's CFO is my own son, Nathaniel. Why are we here? Who joined Chertoff following his service in the Bush administration as chief operating officer of FEMA. The Chertoff Group's practice involves consulting with major international corporations and governments on security concerns, as well as an active M&A practice. It is a fascinating business, and I very much enjoy being a small part of it. Unfortunately, Mike's wife could not join us today, and we're sorry about that. He has three grown and married children, two of whom are in the State Department, and one is a defense analyst. General Hayden is in a position to comment authoritatively on trouble spots around the world, and we here at the Forum Club are truly privileged to receive this insider briefing. I know you'll be particularly interested in learning how he feels the Obama administration has been doing in protecting our national security. But ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure for me to introduce my friend, General Michael Hayden.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, good afternoon, and thanks for the opportunity to be with you here this afternoon. One of the questions I normally get for groups like yours when I'm asked to come and share a few thoughts is kind of what keeps you awake at night? All right? And I remind folks, I've been out of government for 3 years, so almost nothing. Okay? But if I were in government, there are four or five things I would like to share with you. So that's kind of the basic outline of five things that could go bump in the night to make our lives far less comfortable and secure. But before I launch into that list of five, I've got to do a little preliminary work. All right? Number one, this is the text of today's lunch. Okay? Now, you're probably happy that it's that short. I do it this way because if I write down a prepared text, I actually have to be reviewed by CIA for content and classification. If I'm going to write an article about bass fishing in the Monongahela River in my hometown in Pittsburgh, I still have to send it in. But notes? No. Number two, I've been in America's Air Force for 39 years, so I want you to take note that I will attempt to speak to you for a period of time in excess of 3 minutes without using PowerPoint slides. If I get a little wobbly up here, you understand. And finally, I kind of have to put a warning label on what it is I'm going to tell you. Because, in essence, you've come here, and what I'm going to talk about is kind of about policy. Okay? But I'm not a policy guy. I'm the intel guy. And there's a difference. And the intel guy has a different worldview from the policymaker. Let me give you a sense. I mean, look. No, I understand. I took part in the policy process, but I did not decide on policy. If we picture this as, you know, policy is this big room with a shingle on it saying policy, there are a bunch of doors into that room. One of those doors says the intel guy. Another door says the decision maker. I always came through the door marked intel guy. And he's different than the decision maker. By the way, this applies down at the squadron in the Air Force, and it applies when you're in the Oval Office briefing the chief executive of the United States. So what are the differences? I always viewed myself as the fact guy. The policymaker, he's the vision guy. I mean, when was the last time you voted for somebody for president because he was a master of the facts? Yeah, I usually get to laugh. I'm not sure why. Okay. My education is through Catholic liberal arts, so I had more than a full dose of philosophy, all right? And I know the difference between different forms of logic, okay? I am, as the intel guy, the fact guy, fact-based, inherently inductive, okay? I am swimming in a sea of particular pieces of data, and from it, I try to create generalized trends, you know, things you need to know. The policy guy, he's not. He's inherently deductive. He is, by habit, taking his first principles and trying to apply them to specific situations. And finally, as the intel fact-based inductive guy, I am inherently pessimistic. Okay? Bob Gates, before he became Secretary of Defense, was DCI. And Secretary Gates had a wonderful way of describing what I just told you. He said, when a CIA officer stops to smell the flowers, he looks for the hearse. Okay. The policymaker, though, is inherently optimistic. I mean, think of the cognitive dissonance of a policymaker who is inherently a pessimist. I mean, you would never have applied for the job if you didn't think you could do something to make things different. You know, the way I would summarize it, he's the world as we want it to be guy. I'm the world as we're finding it guy. So, these four or five things I'm going to list for you now are the things I think the world as it is guys are now trying to bring up and force in front of the world as we want it to be people. All right? So let me begin. Number one's Iran, all right? And I must tell you, in the circles I run in, if you kind of come to folks with my kind of background or my kind of interest and say, hey, what are you worried most about? 95 out of 100 right now are saying Iran, Okay? Of all the things I left while I was in government, this is the one that has continued in an almost uninterrupted arc that gets darker and darker. And look, and I'm really talking about the Iranian nuclear program, all right, and what that holds in store for us. Three successive administrations, and I'm familiar with two, Bush and Obama, have tried everything we know to make those centrifuges and Natanz stop spinning. Okay? We have, for example, the first 18 months under President Obama, we tried to hug Iran. We tried to engage them. Centrifuges spun. Now under President Obama, like under President Bush, we're trying to sanction Iran. And they're really tough sanctions. Centrifuges are still spinning. Riots in the streets of Tehran in summer of 2009. Centrifuges keep spinning. Okay? The way I look, well, we can talk a lot about this, but I want to hit key points and leave time for questions. But the way I kind of describe this, if you think this Iranian nuclear problem, picture it as a highway, okay, and the off-ramps are starting to pop up in our rearview mirror. Okay, the off-ramp that says, why don't you engage these guys? Kind of in our rearview mirror. Why don't you sanction these guys? Well, it's kind of starting to appear in our rearview mirror. Why don't you change the regime? Well, that kind of is in our and now I'm just beginning to make out, oh, there's a fork in the road up there. And I'm getting pretty close to the fork, and I'm beginning to just make out the outlines of the signage at the fork in the road. And the signs say, do something or do nothing. And I suspect, just based on the facts of the case, sometime during the next presidential term, our car is going to get to that point in the highway. And we're going to have to make a decision. Now, by the way, I mean, we talk a lot more about the Iranians. I won't do it. But in this case, as in several of the other ones I'm going to tell you about, the Iranian thing is an expression of a broader problem. And here the broader problem is the whole question of proliferation. Right? This is not the only problem with regard to proliferation. I could have just spent the last 7 minutes talking about North Korea. You and I could wring our hands and fret about Pakistan having so many weapons. And the macro problem that makes the Iranian problem so hard is that we, and I mean that, that's you and us, you and me, okay, we have not yet answered the question definitively with regard to proliferation. What are we really prepared to do? What are we really prepared to live with? We've not answered it. And we're seeing a specific expression of that unanswered question in Iran. So that's number one. But let me just spend one more minute on Iran, because as I told you, you ask 100 folks with my kind of background, 95 will say Iran. If somebody goes dramatic in 2012 because of this problem, it will not be us. And I'm going to tell you now, I am really confident it will not be the Israelis. Well, you can ask questions on that. If something goes bump in 2012, it'll probably be the Iranians, and it'll probably come out of a hideous miscalculation. You know, if you look at what's going on in Iran now, I mean, they're kind of engaged in a steel cage death match among different elements inside Iranian society about who's running these things. I am perfectly capable of imagining circumstances where somebody in Iran, for domestic purposes, decides to do something externally because it helps them domestically, and they're kind of indifferent to what happens in the broader world. By the way, the Iranian political system is not the only one that's capable of those kinds of actions. Okay, but this one's peculiarly dangerous. Okay, Iran, enough. On to Roman numeral two in your outline. China. And my first sentence after China is, I apologize for mentioning China in the same breath as Iran. It's not the same thing, all right? I laid out a pretty dark, dangerous scenario with regard to Iran. China is just, it just is. And what's going on in China is a development with which we must cope, with which we must deal. China is getting stronger. China is getting bigger. China is getting more powerful. That's neither good nor bad. In my line of work, it just is. And now, because of that, we've got to do certain things. One of the certain things we've done is, did you read the press accounts 2 or 3 weeks ago about the administration's new defense policy. Okay, there are some clear guideposts inside that defense policy, which kind of, I mean, look, defense policy is like everything else. It is never black and white. It is never binary. But we are shifting our weight from South Asia in the direction of the Far East, militarily. Within the Department of Defense, we're shifting our weight off of our ground forces, be they called the Army or the Marine Corps, shifting weight off of ground forces, and shifting our weight in the direction of sea and air forces, forces that will be of more value in what will be the coming competition in the Western Pacific, South Asia, the Indian Ocean. They're just better tools for us for this coming problem. Look, China is not an enemy of the United States. There are no good reasons for China to become an enemy of the United States. There are logical, non-heroic policy choices for us and the Chinese that keep this relationship forever competitive, occasionally confrontational, never conflictual. So everything I've just told you about shifting weight and moving forces and changing the mix of forces is not because I'm predicting a war with China. All I want to do, all I think we want to do, is to have sufficient power in that part of the world to make it much more difficult for the Chinese to do something stupid 3, 5, 10, or 15 years from now. Do you understand my meaning? One additional point about China, and again, kind of coming back to my world as the intel guy and so on, you have to just look up here for a minute, okay? We know life does not go in that kind of straight line. So do not project China's development into the future as simply a continuation of what you've seen in the last several years. There are difficult, inherent, structural problems within Chinese society with which they must cope, and it is not clear that their society and their political structure has the elasticity that yours and mine has to deal with them. Let me give you some examples. Demography. Remember the classic demographic pyramid? In China, because of the one-child policy for several generations now, it's like this. One Chinese demographer, quite insightful, has pointed out, China is probably the first modernizing nation in our history, history of mankind, that will get old before it becomes rich. The demographer also points out, hey, you guys in the West, every time we do something, you multiply it by 1.3 billion. We divide. There are serious environmental problems in China, incredible problems with the maldistribution of wealth between coast and inland. And who's in charge there anyway, and why are they? It's the Chinese Communist Party. And it has nothing to do with Marx, Engels, Lenin, or even Mao Zedong. It has everything to do with 10% GDP growth per year. And when that nose is over, and it will nose over, what is the legitimacy of the Communist Party to continue to govern China? So you kind of got, on the one hand, on the other hand, when it comes to China, but it's a big deal and one with which we must cope. The third Roman numeral in this outline may surprise you. Mexico. Since President Calderon came to power in 2006 and declared war on the drug cartels, about 50,000 Mexicans have died violently at the hands of the cartels. There are swaths of Mexican territory that are essentially beyond the control of the Mexican government. This question actually came to us when, in 2007-2008, after President Calderon came to power, and he actually came to the United States saying, hey, we got a problem. We, Mexicans and the United States, we need to work on it jointly. And we did do some things. There's something called Merida, the Merida Initiative, which is $1.4 billion of your tax dollars trying to help the Mexican state be more secure. Okay? It's a really important question. We and Mexico are a common economic zone because of NAFTA. this common economic zone cannot survive if the security environment and the two halves of the zone are so different. A common economic zone demands the free flow, goods, people, services, ideas. If you have to thicken the border because of the deteriorating security situation in Mexico, that flies in the face of the entire concept of NAFTA. And I would also suggest to you that you shouldn't think of this as let's just build a fence and keep it on that side. There's a wonderful book. It was summarized in the Washington Post, and my son got it for me for Christmas. It talks about I'll get the title wrong, The American Nations. And it talks about a dozen regions of the United States. You know, there's Yankeedom, okay? All right. The Left Coast is another, okay? There's one, I believe, is called El Norte. And it straddles the Rio Grande, Rio Bravo, and the New Mexican-Arizona border. Straddles. The point being, that is a common commercial, cultural, linguistic zone. In a sense, the political border is a bit artificial when it comes to the realities of the commonalities on both sides. And again, I repeat, if on the Mexican side of that political border you have all this violence, if this truly is a common zone, it cannot be contained there. One final note as to why this is really important. That should be enough, but there's another reason. In my line of work, which I've done for four decades, I never worried a jot about North America. North America was not part of the security universe of the United States. We could put all of our psychic and physical energy worrying about other stuff, you know, kind of the over there. If this situation in Mexico is not righted, you will find more and more of your nation's security energy, more and more of your nation's security resources consumed by a problem we never had before. I told you I was a pessimist. Let me give you one ray of sunlight on this problem. Never before has the Mexican government wanted to cooperate more with the American government than they do today. We both carry a very heavy burden of history from the 1840s and the Mexican War. And the idea of these two countries cooperating has never been on either of our scopes. There is a Mexican military liaison officer, as I speak, at U.S. Northern Command in Colorado Springs, Colorado. That is almost an unnatural act when you look at the history of American-Mexican relations. So this actually gives us an opportunity to change the strategic equation a bit in North America. Look, it is never going to look like the northern border, but it could look very different than it has for most of our lifetimes. That's number three. Okay, so what have I done? Iran, China, Mexico. Number four, cyber threats. Okay. Now, Iran could go bump and hurt you. China over time could affect you. Mexico could affect you. This cyber thing could hit you as you're walking out the door. Okay, as you reach in your pocket and grab your BlackBerry or your iPhone or go online to do some banking or whatever else you might want to do online. This cyber threat is the one thing I'm going to tell you about that's going to hit you most personally. Let me give you very quickly why I think this stuff is why this thing is so bad. Okay, why so many things are happening out there in the cyber domain. You all understand what I'm talking about, right? Talking about the World Wide Web and so on. You know, where did this thing come from? You know, it was invented. Not by that one fall, but it was invented, okay? It was invented by the American Department of Defense. It was invented by an organization at that time called ARPA, now called DARPA, the Advanced Research Projects Agency. And 30 or 40 years ago, what ARPA wanted to do, okay, the big idea, the technological thrust, okay, was how do I move a lot of information really quickly and really easily between a limited number of nodes, which were the labs, okay, all of whom I know and all of whom I trust. Get it? The whole thing is designed. How do I move stuff quickly and easily to a limited number of nodes, all of whom are known and trusted. Got it? Okay. That remains the design principle of today's internet, which has an almost infinite number of nodes, most of whom are unknown, and a whole bunch of whom do not deserve to be trusted. This thing was not built to protect your stuff. Trust was implicit in the inherent design of this thing. That's why it's so easy for all these bad things to happen. Now, most of the bad things, it's just about stealing your stuff. Okay? It's your credit card number, it's private information, it's intellectual property, it's trade secrets, it's stealing stuff. And that's really bad. And it's bad enough. But that's not the only thing that can happen there. Remember the first topic, Iran? Okay. Hold that in your head. And now remember this topic, cyber. And I'm going to crash the two together. Have you ever heard of anything called Stuxnet? Okay. All right. For those of you who haven't, Stuxnet was a computer-generated attack against the control systems of the Iranian centrifuges at their center at Natanz. Someone, almost certainly a nation state or nation states, because this is so complex, this can't be done in your mom's basement or your dad's garage. Okay. Someone launched a computer attack against the control system of one cascade of centrifuges at Natanz, controlled about 1,000 centrifuges, sent orders to the centrifuges to spin at self-destructive speeds while telling the operator, everything's cool. Okay. Nothing wrong here. Pay no attention to the loud noises in the next room. And 1,000 centrifuges destroy themselves. Okay. Now, remember problem one, Iran, highway, going down the road? What I just told you is almost an unalloyed good, right, with regard to problem one. And it is. I applaud whoever did it. but let me rehearse for you what I just told you. Let me just use slightly different words. Somebody out there, almost certainly a nation state or two, okay, has just used a computer weapon and viewed it to be a legitimate act of, fill in the blank, self-defense, counterproliferation. Just used a computer weapon as a legitimate act to destroy what another nation would have to describe as its critical infrastructure in a time of peace. That's a big deal. To use a deep historical metaphor, somebody has crossed the Rubicon. We have got a legion on the other side of the river now. Now, and I don't mean to describe this in terms of relative destruction, all right? But think August 1945. Because we are now in a new place when it comes to cyber threat. And I already told you, it's hard to defend yourself out there because of the way it's designed. Okay, that's number four. Number five is terrorism. And frankly, when I first got out of government 2 or 3 years ago, I spent a little more time on number five. But as pessimistic as I am by nature, number five is a pretty good news story. We have been remarkably successful against al-Qaeda and its affiliates. I attribute that success to the fact that when people attack us, we really get mean. And we have been fairly consistently mean over the course of 2 very different presidents. Look, I've got arguments with some things in the current administration, but fundamentally, the amount of continuity between the 43rd and the 44th presidents of the United States when it comes to fighting terror is a thing to behold, particularly when you hold it up against the campaign rhetoric that you may have heard in 2008. So if you just look up, remember I said I wasn't using PowerPoint, right? But if I had view graphs, this is where I have it. This is the view graph I give you. But since I don't, I'm going to use hand puppets. So look up here. If this is what we're doing, the preferred al-Qaeda mode of attack, the mass casualty thing against the iconic target, World Trade Center 1, 9/11, East Africa embassy bombings, Bojinka, which was multiple airliners over the Pacific, 2006 airliner plot coming out of Great Britain, the hydrogen peroxide plot, you know, the reason you can't bring your toiletries through the TSA checkpoint anymore, all right? Remember, I'm a pessimist, so I never say never, all right? But their ability to do this is really reduced. It really is. These are big, they're complex, and they're slow-moving. And your intelligence services, with your friends' intelligence services, we're actually pretty good at this stuff. And when they start trying to do one of these, there are multiple, there's a multiple threads. There's a training thread, travel thread, forgery thread, operational thread, financial thread. And we're good enough, we grab a thread, and then we start pulling that thing together, and pretty soon we got the whole furball of a plot in front of us. I became director in 2006. That was the height of the hydrogen peroxide plot. Okay, we were all over that plot. The only argument we had with our British friends was, when are you going to arrest these guys? With the Brits wanting to let it run so they could build up evidence for a court case, and we Americans saying, we don't care about the court case. We think they bought the hydrogen peroxide. Arrest these guys. But, I mean, that's a pretty interesting conversation to be able to have. Tells you how much you really knew. So we're kind of okay up here. Never say never, but kind of okay. So what do we get? We get Umar Farooq Abdelmutallab with explosives in his underpants. I'm sorry. I got to pause here. Put the TiVo here. Pause the show. The New York Post has some of the best headlines in American journalism. On the morning after the Christmas 2009 attack, okay, December 26, 2009, the front page of the Post was covered with a picture of this mope, Umar Farooq Abdelmutallab, the guy with the underwear thing. Okay. And the headline in the New York Post was, "Great Balls of Fire." We digress. We digress. Okay. So you got the one-off. You got Najibullah Zazi going from Denver to New York to go into the subway system. You got Faisal Shahzad with the SUV in Times Square. You see what I'm describing down here? Now here's the deal. Okay. What do you want me to do with my arm? This is what we're doing now. We're able to stop this. This is happening down here. Well, how much more of your convenience, how much more of your commerce, how much more of your privacy do you want to squeeze for how much more safety? That's where we are now. That's the big question. Because let me let you in on something, all right? This stuff down here, this is penalty. Who are the soccer players here from the school? Yeah, yeah. This stuff down here, that's penalty kicks. This ball is going in the net. Okay. Now, we can make it more likely that we'd stop that. Okay. But it's still penalty kicks. And what I would ask you, as the intel guy, talking to the citizens I'm trying to protect, just give me some guidance. If you want me to squeeze it, you got to let me do that, but you know you're going to pay a price. The line I use with most folks is, how much you want to take off for the TSA guy, okay? And if you say, no, we're cool. Let's leave it here. We're doing pretty well here. Then the deal is, when this happens, and it will, okay? I mean, we all knew that, okay? That was the deal. I mean, life's life. It's the veil of tears, remember? And we move on. We have not yet had that conversation inside the United States. And that's the next big conversation that we need to have. And we've had some conversations about things I did while in government under President Bush, renditions, detentions, interrogations. We're fixing to have another big one about targeted killings, even of Americans. Okay, and those are the kinds of adult conversations we need to have when it comes to terror. But fundamentally, what I've told you is, your security service has done pretty well against these guys. And we still have some more work to do, but these are the kinds of questions. So those are my five, all right? Iran, China, Mexico, cyber, terror. If you'd give me 2 hours, I'd have brought in the fun-loving Kim family from North Korea and talked about them. My favorite populist Latin American dictator, Hugo Chavez. We could have added him to the mix. We'd have talked about the Russians. We sure as God made green apples would have talked about Pakistan and what's going on there. But we had five. So let me stop, and I'd be happy to entertain any comments or questions you might have about any of this. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks.
I know we all want to thank the general for these remarks, and Joe's going to come up with some questions. I also want to say thanks to the general for his commitment and the personal contributions he's made for the safety of our country. And also to thank him and congratulate him for his record of accomplishments. So, we're pleased to have you. We also now would like to give you a couple of books to take home with you. You already know about that.
Okay.
We have the Naples, Florida book, and we have the Marco Island book. And these are for you, and I will take them back to your place.
Thank you.
And I'm going to take a prerogative. I get to ask a first question, Joe, and I'm kidding you, kidding him a little bit, because earlier at his table he said he's never do something, and then during his presentation he said something about never saying never. So I'm going to ask him, if he felt he could make a difference in a political office in the United States, which one would he consider?
This reflects the conversation we had at the table. I am never going back into government service. I have filled out my last financial disclosure form.
Okay, on to the questions. I was a little concerned about our students because the blue cards weren't flowing very fast, but we got a pretty good one here at the end, General. In your opinion, what technological advance has aided the most in the gathering of intelligence in recent years, i.e. stealth?
Yeah. As a practical matter for this war, the one on terror, right, it's unmanned aerial vehicles. All right, it's Predator and... Drones. All right. It gives you the ability. Look, I'm not confirming or denying anything our government hasn't confirmed or denied publicly, but just talking about drones in general, it gives you the ability to unblinkingly stare at an area of Earth. Think back to your childhood and think of your personal knowledge of the neighborhood where you grew up. Okay, so you knew, I can hang out on this corner any time of the day or night. I shouldn't be here after dark. I can go through that alley in daylight, but not after 10 o'clock. When that van is over here, I don't want to be over there. That's the kind of knowledge you can build up if you've got a drone or a series of drones that you can rotate in and just relentlessly stare at a patch of Earth. Now, that makes you very lethal when you want to be lethal, but it also means you can be so patient that you can wait until the precise right opportunity presents itself, so you can be not just lethal but incredibly discriminating in how it is you fight. Now, that's for this war, for this enemy. But of all the things that we've had, that's it. That's the one that's made the biggest difference.
Okay, you've covered the cyber thing, but judging by the number of cards I've got here, I think this is a topic of great interest to the audience here, so I'll just ask this one. What can you tell us about protecting against a massive cyber attack on our electronic networks?
Yeah, it's really interesting. The Edison Electric Institute, which is the trade association for this industry, they are seized of this issue. They really are. Right. I've actually spoken with them and to them and cooperated a bit as they try to develop how much security is enough, what is the real nature of the threat. So they are really working very, very hard. That said, we're going to the smart grid, right? You all familiar with smart grid? That's connecting everything to the Internet so that you can load share, load balance, move power from here to there. I mean, we're trying to create an electrical grid that's almost organic. You know, I don't have to tell my body to sweat. When my body gets hot, it begins to naturally cool. Well, we're trying to build an electrical grid that acts, reacts organically to demand and capacity, okay? Which means it's all connected. If it is all connected through the internet, it means someone in the People's Liberation of Army of China can talk to my toaster. That seems to present certain problems. And so this is one area where we really need to take great care. And maybe the answer is you can go ahead and grid it, but you're going to have to build your, I mean, you know, connect it. But you may not want to use the internet. You may have to go build your own. Now, that's a lot more expensive, okay? But do you understand the issue? Look, if it's connected to the internet, a talented adversary will penetrate it, period.
Okay, several questions along this line. What options are open to the U.S. if Iran does block the Straits of Hormuz? Yeah.
Sink their navy. Sink their navy. Sink the Iranian navy. The question was, what options are available to the United States if the Iranians block the Straits of Hormuz? I don't want to say I don't worry about it, all right? But I do want to say it's not going to stay blocked for long. Okay. We have, no, I mean, look, this is almost like math. Or, you know, it's like a problem in physics. I mean, military power has got a certain science to it, all right? And they do not have the wherewithal. How do they come at, how do they come at the straits? Speedboats, okay. Surface-to-surface missiles, anti-ship missiles, and mining the harbor. Mining the straits. Of the three I just gave you, the most difficult because it's most lingering is mining, right? But all three of them are defeatable, and all three of them will be defeated, and we will do it in concert with our allies because everyone else on the planet has an interest in keeping the straits open. So remember I said the Iranians could go dramatic, but it would be illogical externally. It would be driven by internal. This is illogical externally because they don't have the wherewithal to actually do it. So I mean, it's not something you shouldn't worry about. It's something we're planning for, I'm sure, but this is not something they're capable of doing over any extended period.
Okay. Is Putin losing his grip on Russia?
Oh, on Russia?
Yeah. Well, or Iran or whatever.
No, I just said, is Putin losing? I thought the question was, is Putin period. Losing his grip? Yeah. I don't know a lot about this, but this is interesting. I was the head of two national agencies, NSA and CIA. I was appointed by President Clinton to be the head of NSA, the National Security Agency, President Bush for CIA. I began this 10-year thing, okay, in 1999. Russia was nowhere near the top of any agenda in the following 10-year period. Despite the obsession with it in the preceding 20 or 30 years of my career, while I'm at the national level, Russia's pretty far down. So this is not something that I really routinely dealt with as opposed to some other topics. That said, my judgment is he was really taken aback of so much pushback for his just saying, well, I guess I'll be president again, which was kind of the way he put it. And there was a certain slice of Russian society, the slice you and I would probably be most comfortable with, kind of the entrepreneurs, young, you know, industrial types, who surprisingly went to the streets. Putin just made the assumption, hey, I made this thing better. Remember back then it was all chaos and your pensions were going away and there was crime and there was a war in Georgia and I fixed all that, which is all true. But he kind of overestimated, I think, the sense of gratitude that would still be present. So I think he's elected president again, Joe. But I genuinely caught off stride by the response. Look, remember I said Russia would be in the 10 if we had a longer list? Russia is a declining power. Right? Russia is not China. Okay? Russia is running out of oil. Russia is running out of gas. Russia appears to be running out of democracy. Russia appears to be running out of entrepreneurial spirit. And most importantly of all, Russia is running out of Russians. They have a declining birth rate. There are going to be significantly fewer Russians in a generation. And this is not a country that has been hospitable to immigrants. Okay? This is not a country that said, well, why don't we have a whole bunch of people from those old Central Asian republics come in? You know, the Kyrgyz and the Kazakhs and the Uzbeks. That's not their history. And so you've got this declining energy resource and declining population with which they must deal.
Okay. Will Pakistan help or hinder a Taliban peace deal in Afghanistan?
I don't know. No, and we don't. And I mentioned Pakistan would be in the top 10, and it would be really dark. When I look at Pakistani behavior over the last couple of years, it is hard for me to determine whether or not what Pakistan is doing is because they expect the United States to fail in Afghanistan, or they want the United States to fail in Afghanistan. I don't know. And I could go on for the rest of the afternoon about Pakistan and the American-Pakistani relationship. Look, we have to cooperate with a lot of countries, even our best friends, okay? If their interests are here and our interests are here, even our best friends, we aren't like this. There's always daylight. And in the intel world, you're cooperating with a lot of folks kind of out here like this. I fear, with regard to Pakistan, we're kind of like this. In that common space now, in which we see common value, common interest, is really quite small. And that's really the fundamental problem we have. So the Pakistanis are going to do what suits them.
Okay, this is the last question. Should the TSA and other security agencies employ profiling?
No, absolutely not. That would be counter to American values and culture. They should use intelligence-based screening. Good. No, which is not profiling, but it does allow the TSA agent, based upon the most current intelligence available, to be more rather than less suspicious of behaviors, not people, of behaviors as folks come through the line.
Thank you, General Hayden, and thanks to Joe Fogg and Ehsan for bringing the general to us. We'll see all of you Feb 10.